to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the award-winning composer and musician for TV, film, and video games, Eric Aho. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you very much.
This is going to be another episode where I need you to walk me through this because I'm not actually familiar with this specific thing. So tell us what you have come on the show to talk about. Tell us, we'll give some context around its release, its reception. Tell us why you think it's maligned and why you also think that that is wrong.
Okay, well, I chose True Detective Season 2 and I almost immediately regretted it. It's basically an 8-hour movie with so many plot points and scenes. It's going to be impossible to talk about everything. But it's the if you told me you saw the first season. So the concept of the series is that you have a different plot with different characters and different actors every season. You know, you have these little 8-hour things that are separate on their own. The first season of True Detective was critically acclaimed. Everybody was very excited about it, myself included. I absolutely loved it. And the second season, when it came out, for some reason, people were just, they didn't like it. The critics slammed it. They had a lot of different takes on why it wasn't as good as season one. Where the critics, first, I want to make a couple of concessions. So where I think the critics might have been right was season two was different than season one in that there were multiple directors. And part of this, because of this, the season becomes kind of necessarily so less focused. Maybe because of the form, because of the unique form, that you really do need one director to kind of tie everything together. Also, the form requires an 8-hour movie, basically. Maybe the themes that Nick Pizzolatto was trying to deal with don't take 8 hours to explore. And there's some there's some stuff that happens that maybe just filler or doesn't make it as tight. You know, it doesn't have to be condensed. So there could be a fair amount of digressions. Acting, Vince Vaughn took a lot of criticism for his acting. But I really liked the fact that, Vince Vaughn and Pizzolatto took a risk here. They went against, type, and whether it was success or a failure, I really respected the fact that they took a risk there with Vince Vaughn. And he did, you know, you can tell he tried to do an earnestly good job. Some scenes were better than others, but, overall, I think that's a fair criticism. All the other criticisms I read, especially on internet media critics, some of the newer website voices were just inane to me. The most honest criticism I heard, and I actually heard this from a fair number of people, including my wife, was that I just didn't like it.
Which may well be true, but it's very nebulous, isn't it?
It's nebulous, and I think the critics were trying to come up with reasons why, and none of their reasons, besides the ones I'd already mentioned, to me made any sense at all. Most of them are just downright silly. Would you like me to walk you through the kind of set the stage of the characters, or kind of what the overall plot was?
Well, let's get into that shortly. First of all, I want to talk about, you're right, there was an enormous amount of anticipation for season two, because yes, I saw season one and I liked it well enough. I wasn't as enamored of it as some people, especially when some of the influences started to really show through and I was like, hang on a second. But it was very well performed, very well directed and well paced. And you could make the argument that there wasn't enough in season one to fill out 8 hours, but because of the way it was paced, the framing device they used, which was excellent, I thought, and just the way the story was told, they I don't want to use the phrase got away with it, but you know what I mean. They made it work, even though the actual plot of season one, once you strip away the affectation and the sort of, you know, the framing device to increase the mystery, all of that, the actual plot is pretty thin. There isn't an awful lot there. But it did work. And you have to wonder how much of that was down to Cary Fukunaga, the director. Because, you know, you had so many of the same elements in place for season two, except him. And, you know, I've seen several, especially with this new movie of his, Beasts of No Nation, coming out, I've seen many people sort of like point to that and go, ahaha, now we know why season one of True Detective was so good. Now, I should say that the reason I haven't watched season two yet was simply because it hasn't been on TV over here yet on anything except, like, you know, pay cable.
Right.
So I didn't not watch it for any reason. But of course, now I already know that a large number of people have said how bad it is. So that has kind of colored, well, will I ever bother to watch it when it does come on TV? I just don't know.
Well, let me try to sell you why you
please
should
do,
watch
please
it.
Please do, please
do. And I agree. I mean, I think Fukunaga is such a brilliant director. And not that the directors that worked on season two were bad, but I think he is so exceptional that, you know, he can make things work. Mm-hmm. I think your point about season one having the same problems as season two, I think is spot on. I didn't see anything in season two, that I didn't see in season one that, was a weakness. I thought the weaknesses were the same across the board. Again, excluding the multiple directors and maybe the acting with Vince Vaughn. But again, I like the risk they took there.
Sure.
I think where I wanted to start, and this is a digression and I promised one, is kind of with the mythology of California. And one of the reasons why I have a soft spot in my heart for this kind of show, which is like a modern noir, as well as the first season, they're both noirs with hard-boiled detectives, I've always been fascinated with the history of California. And California, there's this whole mythology around it. California was the land of dreams even before Hollywood came here. It was as far west as you could go in the world. It was the end of the line as far as immigration from Europe. It was always associated with dreams of utopia. But it also had, you know, the utopia had this dark side that was, that always was, went hand in hand with the stories of, people finding gold or people, you know, finding oil. And so you have all these wonderfully tragic stories, starting with the gold rush in San Francisco and some of the stuff that went on the Barbary Coast of San Francisco, you know, corrupt politicians controlling everything. Putting their hands in everybody's pie and, actually in some cases murdering journalists, when they started to call them out on it. And there was one incident in the Barbary Coast in San Francisco where you actually had a mob of 10,000 people, lynch the enforcer of the main politician in San Francisco, the boss. And they lynched this guy because he had murdered a journalist who was kind of exposing what was going on. And for 2 years after that, there was no crime in the city of Los Angeles. So it was this,
wow,
these stories like this, and there are dozens of them in California, where this kind of like American entrepreneurial ambition meets lawlessness. I came across this great quote in the New York Times. And they were talking about the beginning of Los Angeles, and they were talking about an East Coast journalist at the time. His name is Mauro Mayo, and he dubbed Los Angeles simply the hellhole of the West. By 1870, every faith in town except Roman Catholicism has literally boarded up their churches and abandoned LA to Satan. On the East Coast, newspapers printed editorials asking whether Los Angeles ought to change its name to Los Diablos.
Wow.
And so you have, even from the beginning, right? You have the oil rush with Getty, and there was another oil man named Edward Doheny, who was involved in the Teapot Dome scandal, who was the which was kind of the biggest American scandal before Watergate in 1921-22. Basically, they were buying politicians and the Secretary of the Interior, the oil companies were, There Will Be Blood is loosely based on Edward Doheny and his son, Ned Doheny. And there's a mansion, a very famous mansion in Beverly Hills. It's now a public park called Greystone Mansion, right above Doheny. And Ned Doheny, the son of Edward Doheny, was actually murdered there by his male secretary, who was ostensibly his gay lover, and then who then committed suicide immediately afterwards. So you have these, you know, again, the political scandals also coinciding with these weird psychosexual scandals, personal scandals. Griffith Park.
Right. Well, and you've got the, you know, the famous things like the Black Dahlia murders and, you know, in fiction, of course, Chinatown, which, you know, is exactly that, a tale of the political corruption of Los Angeles and, you know, how you can't beat the system and all that. And focuses around a hard-boiled detective. You've got, you know, elsewhere in California, you've got people like Hammett and Chandler writing, basically inventing the hard-boiled detective genre.
Right.
So it does kind of belong in California. It feels like that's always been its natural home.
It really is. And to me, one of the fundamental differences about the first season and the second season is this kind of, it's what the show does really profoundly to me is using geography as a character. So if Louisiana feels kind of like an elemental preternatural hell.
Right. Cause they did do that very well in season one. Yeah.
Right. So the Lovecraft references, the kind of the evil in the soil, it's kind of magically realistic. It references Faulkner, a little more than, you know, it's more about this kind of amorphous primitive evil that, that resides in the ground. And where LA is actually, it's a man-made hell. So it's not some primal evil that resides in the earth. It's something we brought with us. So to your point, the literature is hard-boiled. It's terse. It's about power and urban corruption and decay. And unlike the South, you can't really feel the blood in the ground because, one, it wasn't settled that long ago. Progress in LA, we tend to erase the history as soon as it's made. And, you know, honestly, there is no ground. It's just concrete.
Right. The blood is on the streets.
The blood's on the streets. So that's one thing that I think the show does well in both season one and season two is it kind of takes... it's references from the geography.
So you think that Pizzolatto knows is familiar with this history of California because we know he was raised in Louisiana. So that clearly was a very sort of, you know, drew from, you assume, a lot of personal memories and feelings about that area. But now he lives in California. So do you think it's fair to assume that he's sort of absorbed a lot of what you've just been talking about as well?
I think so. And most of it, you know, I'm a transplant. I've been in LA for 10 years. I'm originally from Seattle and most of it is reading. So if you do your research and you start reading about this stuff and you recognize, the history behind Chinatown and the history behind There Will Be Blood or the history behind LA Confidential, and you read the real stories, it becomes even more amazing because you start to, you know, names like Mulholland or Doheny, the Tejon Ranch, the San Fernando Valley, they're all just history of corruption and people, you know, men seizing real estates in corrupt ways. Really interesting. And I think
so does the show, because remember I haven't seen this season, so does the show really revolve around that and focus on that aspect of Californian history?
It does. And it focuses on a very recent aspect of California history. So the show is basically, it's about a town called Vinci. And Vinci is based on Vernon, which is just south of downtown Los Angeles. And Vernon is 5.2 square miles. It's an industrial wasteland. It has 95 permanent residents.
Wow.
So it's basically just a industrial pit. The city administrator paid himself $900,000 a year to manage 95 residents.
Wow.
In 2010, the state legislature tried to revoke its charter as a city, but failed because the business interests were way too powerful there. So it's basically one family that has ruled this little fiefdom since the early 20th century. The mayor, who is the grandson of the original founder, was just convicted for conspiracy, perjury, and voter fraud. Because he doesn't live in Vinci, but he lives in Hancock Park, but he votes in Vinci so he can control the interests. The son of the mayor, and again, here's this political and personal scandal nexus that happens there. The son of the mayor was sent to prison in 2009 for molesting boys at a Catholic school he ran.
Oh, wow.
The whole thing is just too incredible to believe. And the more you read about it, the more it just kind of blows your mind. So that's where Pizzolatto starts. He starts with Vinci. And in Vinci, he has a mobster who is from the East Coast, but he transplanted to California. Again, a typical story of a Californian, a guy named Frank Semyon. Who is trying to climb his way out of the pit he was born into. He was basically, you know, abused by a drunken father. He just learned to live on the streets, and he's trying to pull himself out of that. And his ultimate ambition is to become, you know, a power elite. He says at some point in the series, we have a chance, this is my one chance to be one of those old Californian families where nobody remembers where the money came from. Right. But that's the way basically all the California money came from. That's the origin of these California families are these men with this will to power that are willing to kind of seize and pull themselves out of things in not necessarily ethical or moral ways. With him, there's the second character is Ray Velcoro, who is played by Colin Farrell, and he's a cop who has basically become very corrupt. There is Antigone Bezieres, who's played by Rachel McAdams, who's another cop, and then Paul Widrow is played by Taylor Kitsch, who's also another cop. The plot of the series is basically the city manager is murdered. And that launches a joint investigation between Vinci PD, Ventura Police Department, and the California Highway Patrol, represented by Ray Velcoro, Annie Bezerides, and Paul Widrow. In the background, we have like a statewide high-speed rail system going in, and there are land deals aplenty going down among very corrupt and very powerful people. And it's so, I mean, the plot gets so convoluted and there's so many plot points that's, you know, but that gives you kind of the background of it.
And it doesn't sound like it. I mean, the place sounds absolutely fascinating, especially if it is based, you know, on a real place, never mind the murder mystery. I just want to see a movie about that place.
Exactly. It's amazing.
Yeah. But then the idea of, yeah, a murder that involves several, you know, police authorities having to work together. This is not a new idea, but it's not a bad idea. We've seen that it can work many times over.
And I think what where Pizzolatto's the strength lies is that he goes beyond the typical tropes. He to me, that it's not even about the plot. It's how the characters evolve in relation to each other and in relation to what's going on, you know, the plot. And that's where I think, to me, Pizzolatto's strength is in the character development and the depth of the characters and the relationships, even the small intimate scenes between the characters. So it's almost, you know, I think it was criticized a little bit for oh, they just stole a bunch of noir plots and they, you know, that's what it is. But to me, that's not even the important part. The important part is the depth of the characters and what Pizzolatto's kind of saying about them.
Well, and I think he showed his affinity for that in season one as well. I mean, the most people's favorite scenes in season one, especially in the early episodes, are the scenes where the two guys are just in the car, you know, just like hating one another, but forced to share a car ride together. And those are some great character scenes in there.
Yeah, they're wonderful. And you know, season one, I was kind of, you know, when you first watch a TV show, you're trying to say, all right, are you going to sell me on this or not? Mm. And after the first two episodes, I was like very ambivalent because there was some high-minded as existentialist philosophy. They were throwing in a little bit of Lovecraft. They were doing this. And then I saw the kind of the behind the scenes interview with Pizzolatto, and he kind of struck me as like a kind of like a sophomoric, you know, recent college grad who's talking about these big existentialist concepts. And then I saw it was the scene between Woody Harrelson and his wife that was so, it struck me as so real, so heartbreaking, so profound. It was just an argument they were having, but it lasted 20 minutes. It felt like it was taking place in real time. There were no shortcuts. It actually, I'm surprised people didn't get bored because I started to feel like it was too long. Because it was a heavy, it was drama, and it was so, the way Woody Harrelson was kind of manipulating his wife, saying, you know, my life as a cop is so tough, so that's why I'm disconnected. And then, you know, and then you find out two scenes later, he's just, you know, having an affair with
yeah.
someone else, you know, it's just kind of an amazing scene. And the way those two scenes interrelated that reveal kind of it's what Pizzolatto does so well is you suddenly reinterpret that scene.
Right. And that's the thing. That was a long scene, but it was compelling, partly because of the performances. Cause you know, the actors were just so good, but then also, yeah, as long as you got to the end of it, like you say, it was almost immediately, sort of had the legs cut out from under it. And you realized that he's just a massive hypocrite.
Right. Exactly. But he's good at manipulating his wife, and it struck me as so real. The relationship.
Absolutely. And I think that character is a perfect example of, people often, you hear this thing about, oh, your characters have to be sympathetic, and, many sort of audience members and, you know, sort of novice and aspiring writers mistake that and think that that means that they have to be likable. And it doesn't. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means that you have to be able to understand where they're coming from. You have to be able to relate to them, not in a good way necessarily, but just in a way that you can go, yeah, okay, if I was that person, this is probably how I would behave. And Woody Harrelson's character in True Detective Season 1 is exactly just the best example of that, because he is such a horrible character, such a horrible man as a character, you know, not likable at all.
Right.
And yet you can relate and sympathize so much, especially, I mean, I don't know so much about female viewers, but certainly as a sort of, you know, rapidly approaching middle-aged man myself, you can, right. you can relate and sympathize so much with that character. I thought it was one of the most interesting and compelling characters that I'd seen on television in many years.
I felt the same way. And the depth that the character had, if I had seen the show when I was in my 20s or in my early 30s, you wouldn't, I didn't have a long-term relationship there. I wasn't in a relationship. I'm in a relationship now with my wife. We have a kid, so I can identify with this character more, again, approaching middle age.
So how does that relate to season two?
Okay. So season two, what that is, I can go through. Well, let's talk about the characters of season two and why I love them as right. much as I loved Woody Harrelson's character.
Well, that's exactly what I'm looking for. Like, is there a sort of comparative character? Because you'd assume that that would be Vince Vaughn's character.
Okay. Vince, what we talked already a little bit about Vince Vaughn's character, but he, so his story is one of ascent. So he starts in hell, and, there's a long, scene where he describes to his wife how he was basically, his dad had gotten drunk and had abandoned him in the basement, because his dad used to lock him in the basement when he got drunk upstairs. And his dad had just left for a week. And so he spent a week in this basement as a child, with no food, no water, listening to the rats crawl around in the pitch black. And so he's this, and so he just kind of learned to survive on the streets. And so his story is of this one of ascent. So he's trying to take the world on its own terms. He realizes it's a corrupt, bad place. All there is power. All you can do is hope to insulate yourself from it. So he wants to, achieve what the power brokers have, some sort of private gated community where he doesn't have to deal with the riffraff. What happens is he gets thrown back because of the land deal. The guy who's murdered, which actually there's a direct correlation in the true story of Vinci. I urge you and all your viewers to read the kind of the journalism on the actual city of Vinci in Los Angeles, because it's fascinating. The guy basically steals his money, and he's basically bet everything on this land deal. So he's forced to go back down the ladder. He's forced to go back down into these clubs and deal with drug dealers and start to kind of rebuild his criminal empire that he was trying to leave behind, that he'd kind of let go. He's kind of one of these men like we find in California that are trying to achieve things and are not doing it in ethical ways. But he doesn't quite see the big picture, right? He's not quite, because he comes from a non-privileged background. He doesn't quite see what these other men do. He's not seeing how he's being used. He's not seeing how, he can't compete with the people he's trying to compete with. So, similar to Chinatown, where he's dealing with people he doesn't even understand. He doesn't even understand the game. And, you could look at it both ways, but the redeeming, thing in his character, and again, it has its upside and its bad side, is that he has a very good relationship with his wife, and they care about each other deeply, and they're connected, in a number of, profound ways. And again, some of the conversations between him and his wife are just absolutely profound. They're basically trying to have a baby, and they're having trouble doing that. And he, there's an impotence in a lot of, and I think Pizzolatto explores this a lot with men, and masculinity and male characters, these hard-boiled characters. There's an impotence sometimes at the core of them that's like, and it's very obvious in this scene where he can't get his wife pregnant, and they're talking about adoption and CVS and infertility treatments. And, that kind of dynamic with his wife, again, it grounds it in this really real, every day. Oh, even this gangster guy is, kind of in a Tony Soprano-ish way. You're seeing the background of the gangster filled out. He becomes a real character. And so over the course of this series, his struggle, he hits a ceiling, of course, right? Because he doesn't know who he's dealing with. He has some successes. He does his best. And I hope I'm not spoiling this for anybody, but...
I wouldn't worry about that. I think, like I say, it's only been on pay cable over here in the UK, but really, I mean, if you wanted to see it by now, you would have.
you would have. Okay. All right. And I hope I'm not spoiling this for you either, but, the redemption he is redeemed at the end, but and I want to talk about the ending, of season two compared to season one, because I think that's a really interesting comparison too. I actually think the ending of season two was more correct than season one.
Okay, that'll be interesting. Let's get to that later then, because I have thoughts about the end of season one. I have opinions.
Yeah, I do too. And I think, anyway, so if your opinions are similar to mine, I really think the season, the way Semyon's character, there's a redemption there, but he dies. But he, and it's a really beautiful to me, and it was criticized. To me, it's beautiful writing. The end of Semyon's character. I don't think the directing maybe quite got there for some reason. I'm not sure why. And I think the most of the criticism could probably be blamed on the directing. But he's basically walking through the desert after he's been stabbed and abandoned, and he's gonna walk his way out of the desert before he bleeds to death. And you know, he's maybe got 25 miles, and as he's walking through the desert, all his past is coming to haunt him. So his father's coming, and his and he's agreed to meet, he's supposed to meet his wife in Venezuela in a town square, and she's supposed to be dressed in a white dress. And so his past is kind of, you know, everything about his past is coming out and haunting him. And he keeps struggling through while holding his chest. And then he sees his wife in the distance in the desert. And he walks up to her and she's dressed in a white dress. And then he basically says something, you know, I'm coming to meet you. I'm going to make it to Venezuela. And she goes like, you're already gone. And he turns around and his body's about, 50 yards behind him, passed out in the sand.
I like that.
The redemption of the character is that he ultimately at the end, he puts his wife and even his friends, who he becomes very close with, the corrupt cop, Ray Velcoro, and the other, cop, Annie Bezerides, he kind of brings them in. They kind of become this weird dysfunctional family a couple episodes before the end, and he basically there's a quote that says relationships are the most important thing. I'm paraphrasing, but in the second to the last episode, that becomes his kind of like his realization that you know, it doesn't, I'm not going to climb myself out of hell trying to become powerful. I'm going to climb myself out of hell by focusing on relationships.
Which is a very American fiction attitude. I've talked about this before on the show. That's a very American approach to redemption, I think.
Yeah. I don't know, because I'm American.
You could possibly say a very Californian attitude as well.
It could be.
But so, I mean, it's notable, I think, that you haven't really discussed the murder plot much. Which I think sort of speaks to what you were saying earlier about how, the majority of Pizzolatto's strength is in character rather than plot.
Yes. And the plot is, it's 8 hours of plot. It's it's more convoluted, I think, than the first season.
Right. Which was fairly straightforward, as I say, once you take out the sort of tricksy, sort of shifting time viewpoint back and forth, the actual story was fairly straightforward.
Yes. Yeah, it was. And, you know, the simple plot is, you know, they're investigating this murder, and there's this kind of background of political corruption going on, which again is a trope and has been done a lot before, but, again, it's the, and has probably been done better. I mean, if China, you know, Chinatown to me is one of my favorite movies. And again, why I have a resonance with this is that I want there to be, personally, I want there to be more of this kind of exploration of honest corruption, like an honest exploration, like an actual, like, I just like the whole form of the LA daylight noir. But again, I think the reason why I love season two specifically is the characters. To me, Ray Semyon wasn't actually the most fascinating character. He was probably number two or three. any Bezerit, and speaking, going back to like American tropes and American, the American psyche and what goes on in the mind of the American, as we're witnessing now with the what's going on in the news, politically and otherwise. Annie Bezerides is totally fascinating to me, that character. Her background, so she's a cop with Ventura County Police, and her background, she was raised by a cult member, basically like an alternative religious guru in LA, which is another thing that you know, is so Californian. You have everything from Scientology to Heaven's Gate to Jack Parsons to Esalon, which is the kind of alternative new agey retreat up in Big Sur, which is actually it's disguised. It's in season two, the place where Annie's father is teaching currently is a thinly disguised Esalon.
Right.
Even going forward back as Dashiell Hammett, he wrote The Dane Curse, and this was it explored this kind of cult scam in San Francisco in the 30s. It was kind of the central antagonist in The Dane Curse. And so Annie is this daughter of this religious cult member, and you also have the hippie movement in California. You have all these things, and you have, the second generation after utopia is declared, right? After you live on the commune and you raise children there, these children grow up and they're not enlightened beings. They're just as messed up as anybody else, maybe more so, because the nature of life on a commune is I don't know, lawless, but it's more free.
Anarchic. Yeah. Yeah.
Anarchic by design.
And what happens when those people grow up and realize that they're actually not living in utopia after all?
Exactly. And so Annie Bezerides is, Pizzolatto does it so well. There's a conversation in the first episode where she's having this conversation with her dad, and it's about her sister, who is basically a porn star and a prostitute. And Bezerides went the exact opposite direction than her sister. So his sister kind of went the free love, decadent. And then Bezerides went the kind of martial, puritanical cop route, where she's gonna... and so we go from... All right, so the conversation she's having with her father, at one point, she says, she's worried about her prostitute sister, and her father says to her, "Your whole identity is just a reaction against me." And it really says so much about her character. And for Pizzolatto to frame that in a conversation between the two characters is just great to me, because then you can see her. I see that kind of, reaction to the parents. It to me is kind of a representation of the American psyche. So if you have the puritanical streak in America, and then you also have this kind of like Wild West, anything goes decadent streak in America, you kind of have the American psyche is kind of made up of those two things. And they're bipolar.
Right. They're constantly clashing.
They're constantly clashing, and there's very little moderation. Nobody's kind of, it's the problem at the core of our culture is that we're not moderated. It's either on or off. You're either like a Puritan or it's Miley Cyrus. there's very little like, in between. So you have, this example of where we're going from this kind of religious devotee and her father, who's, there's also a decadence there, right, with the free love thing, but she becomes this cop that's all about authority and like making the world right through strength. And it's her strategy to deal with the bad things in the world. Whereas the other strategy was to kind of like free love. Everybody makes their own rules and you try to become spiritually enlightened. So Bezerides has kind of shut love and spirituality out of her life and replaced it with this kind of martial ethos, utilitarian sex. So she has sex for purely physical reasons. She's more male than the guys she's dating on the police force,
right?
As far as like, and she's very upfront about it. There's some great scenes with her and the guy she's currently sleeping with on the force, who wants to kind of develop a relationship with her. And she's basically like, this is not the time to talk about it. You know, she's very like, get out of my apartment now.
Right. Like the stereotypical male character who, runs away from any kind of commitment.
Right. No, yes, exactly. But she's even more like, I don't think a guy would ever just be like, okay, get out of my apartment now. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
There's a couch. It wouldn't be that direct. And that she's got this real desire to kind of like suppress the corruption. So she sees the corruption in the world and she wants to suppress it. She wants to fight against it. She's trying to save the world in her own way.
So what about Colin Farrell's character then, to sort of round out the triumvirate?
This is definitely my favorite character, the whole thing. It is in the great tradition of like Hammett, Sam Spade, and Chandler's Philip Marlowe or Jake Giddies. And there's something about these characters that are so appealing to me because they're broken, right? They are or were formerly good men, maybe a bit naive, but who've come in contact with the real world and just been crushed by it, right? Mm-hmm. They're like this again, and I think Hammett and Chandler invented this idea of the tough talking, like hard boiled guy, but with a weak heart. Even in Sin City, Bruce Willis's character, where he's dying, you know what I mean? From a heart, he's taking heart pills.
It's that line. I don't remember the exact line, but it's something like the best man in a world full of bad men.
Right. Which doesn't mean they're good, because traditionally in noir, everybody's dirty.
Exactly. Just best. It's a relative term.
Right. And, they're characters like Han Solo or Edmond Dantes that I also see that are kind of in a similar vein. These men that have either boyish illusions about the world or have soft hearts, that have to kind of build up a wall or have to build up some kind of way to deal with the world. Velcoro is definitely the shadow side of all those characters. So he's way more corrupt than Spade or Marlowe. If Semyon is kind of ascending out of hell, then Velcoro is his arc is going straight down. And the way they meet halfway in the show, to me, on Velcoro's way down and Semyon's way up, is where some of those scenes are fantastic too, I think. And that idea of one character going up, one character going down, and kind of meeting in the middle is kind of cool. So Velcaro starts out as a fairly boy scoutish cop who wants, I think he's CHP, and he wants to kind of, he comes from a cop family, but his dad was pretty much a thug cop, like you had to be in the early LAPD.
Mm-hmm.
As we all, we know from at least LA Confidential and Chinatown and whatever else. It's kind of the mythos, but it's all there. So he's kind of this generation after that. And he wants to kind of transcend the corruption of his father. And he starts somewhere up in the clouds thinking he can enforce justice and do good in the world. And then he's kind of thrown down into the pit. His wife is raped by an unknown criminal, and it kind of ends up destroying him. He feels guilty over not being able to protect her. And this sense of impotence because he can't bring the rapist to justice. And that's kind of where it starts. I found like his character and his kind of like what's happening to him. Again, it's Pizzolatto exploring kind of maleness and masculinity and how male is it to this desire to protect your loved ones, to mete out justice, to protect the innocent from evil. But it's almost like a boyish, it's a boyish masculinity. Because in Velcoro, it completely turns pathological. And Pizzolatto kind of shows us where this kind of pure, conservative, boyish, and heroic desire to be an enforcer of God's justice on earth can lead us. So Velcoro basically makes a deal with Semyon in order to get justice. So Semyon kind of summons him to Vinci and says, I heard about what happened with your wife. I'm so sorry about it. And again, this is the first episode, so you don't really know, you don't really know if Semyon's lying or if he's just trying to manipulate him, or of course he's playing two angles because he wants a cop who's a friend, and he wants to be able to use that card when he wants to. But Velcoro basically takes the information from Semyon and ends up killing the guy who Semyon told him raped his wife. So he basically makes a deal with the devil to kind of meet his emotional need of avenging his wife.
Right.
The other thing, and I'm not going to go into this a lot because it's just one of those things you can't cover, but there's a question at the center of the whole show, whether his son, and Velcoro knows it. It's a question in Velcoro's mind, whether his son is the product of the rape or his product. And his son is very overweight, red haired, gets picked on at school. And so there's a very likely, you know, you're led to believe that he's probably not Velcoro's kid.
Looks absolutely nothing like Colin Farrell. Yeah,
exactly. So, and Velcoro, you know, if there's anything at the center of Velcoro, because they divorce, you know, this deal that he's made with the devil destroys his marriage. It begins to destroy the relationship with his son because he's out of control. He's drunk. He's halfway through the first episode, we see him, you know, basically becoming Semyon's enforcer and just doing things that are so wrong. It's unbelievable, right? So it's this Sam Spade, but a very, very shadowy version. And, you know, it's this, you know, Dashiell Hammett started in the Pinkertons. So there was this theory that, you know, and Dashiell Hammett died of, I think early of alcoholism, and part of the hard boiledness, part of the alcohol like fueled cop persona that Hammett and Chandler created, people theorized that it was due to Hammett's early participation in the Pinkertons and the kind of union busting he did and the innocent men he you know beat within an inch of their life,
right? And a sense of guilt, yeah,
a sense of guilt. So there's these scenes that are just brutal with Velcoro. So at some point his son gets his shoes stolen at school, and Velcoro's drunk when he's picking up his kid, and he ends up drunkenly threatening his son to get the name of the bully, to the point where he's threatening to pull his son's pants down in front of the cheerleaders and spank him right there, and calling him a pussy, and just stuff that like any good parent wouldn't do, right?
Right.
but his motivation is to save his son from this humiliation, and in this kind of misguided, drunken attempt to save his son from humiliation, he's even further doing damage to his son, even further humiliating his son. It's just kind of where he leads, or where that path leads.
So I think the biggest question has got to be on my mind, really, after all this, is if this had been season one, do you think that the show would, you know, have built up the same kind of audience and accolades and appreciation that it did with the season one that we had? If this had been, because there was so much anticipation, it's inevitable you're going to disappoint some people, no matter what you do. But if there hadn't been that anticipation, if this had just been season one, do you think it would have been better received?
I don't know. It's a really good question. There are a lot of dynamics going on there. I think your point about it, you know, there being some kind of necessary disappointment to the whole thing, is completely correct. You know, there was so much hype around the first season, so much kind of like critical accolades that, you know, you're bound to fall. It's kind of like, again, yeah, like an American, you know, oh, I think you talked about that too. The Brits do it too, right? Where you build something up and then you have to crush it down because it's too big.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Yeah. So definitely some of that. But I also think, you know, there was the kind of supernatural thing about the first season, I think really intrigued a lot of people. It was this kind of like, it was kind of a Lynchian type, like, you know, otherworldly, something else is going on here thing to it, that I think a lot of people thought were cool. And maybe because I think that came out of Louisiana again, and maybe because this was set in LA and you didn't have that kind of supernatural aspect to it, you wouldn't have that kind of appeal.
Right.
But you don't really find out. It's interesting because you don't find out until the end. It just becomes, you know, the person that's murdered in season two is murdered by two kids he molested earlier in their lives. They come back and they get their revenge. But the in the second episode, there's a scene where Velcoro actually gets shot point blank with a shotgun by a man in a bird mask. And it's so freaky and so weird and so kind of, it recalls that kind of otherworldly thing.
Right. The occult links.
So maybe that would have had the same effect or appealed to the same people. But I don't know. It's an interesting question. I do think, you know, I had conspiracy theory about it for a while. I think like I was thinking Pizzolano didn't kiss enough. Well, he didn't talk to enough critics, or he maybe made some critics mad.
Oh, and so the critics kind of decided to do him over with season two.
Exactly. So
yeah, I honestly don't know enough about the behind the scenes to know whether that's plausible.
I don't think it's plausible, but I did think about it for a hot minute.
It certainly didn't help that post season one, all the stuff about Robert Ligotti's work came out, and the accusations of plagiarism and what have you.
I didn't hear about that.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay. Well, I'm not, it's quite, I won't go into it in detail because it's quite a long story, but look it up. Yeah, there's an obscure, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean, he's genuinely obscure, American horror writer called Robert Ligotti, whose fiction is often sort of ultra nihilistic and has a central philosophy, not unlike, you know, the sort of Lovecraft mythos philosophy, but which is encapsulated and quoted by the Rust Cole character in season one of True Detective. And there were all sorts of accusations flying around. That didn't bother me too much. I mean, the word for word stuff was a bit strong, but you know, at least if you're going to have influences, at least wear them on your sleeve. You know, I think most people's problem with it was more that there was no, Pizzolato didn't mention Ligotti until somebody else brought it up, which felt a bit, you know, not really cricket.
Yeah, no, I would say that's probably not, if he admits he's an influence and he's really, you know, it's an inspiration, at least for the character, you should probably give him credit. If he's ripping off dialogue, you should probably give him writing credit and some back end, you know?
Right. I don't know whether it was ripping off dialogue so much as using what had been descriptive prose as dialogue, if you know what I mean, taking passages from Ligotti's work and putting them in the mouth of the Ross Cole character. But I must admit, I am not a lawyer, nor do I play one on TV, and I didn't look into it in great depth. So
sure,
I just know that obviously that was something else that may have had the potential to turn a certain amount of the media against him and maybe make them, let's say, predisposed to, you know, to require an even higher bar for season two of True Detective in order for them to be impressed.
I can see that. And I don't know. I mean, season one, again, I think some of the criticisms were valid. And I think season one, as a whole, probably is a little stronger, but most of the criticisms I have read, were just, you know, weren't fair.
Right.
And there is, yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's bring it to a close there. I am actually now possibly a little more inclined to watch it when it comes on TV over here. Maybe, well, because the plot element of season one, like I say, was never the strongest anyway. It worked in conjunction with the characters, but, you know, the actual plot was never the main attraction, especially as I came to realize towards the end of season one that actually it clearly wasn't going to be supernatural. And that was all a big fake out, which nothing wrong with. But when I realized that, I was like, okay, let's focus on the characters instead. And so if, as you say, the characters are the strongest thing in season two, then yeah, maybe I will give it a look.
They are. They definitely are. And I think it is worth a look. It is 8-hour commitment. So,
Hey, I,
don't give me a call later and go, you.
Hey, I watch network like cop procedurals. That's, you know, that's 22 hours a year. So
this is much better than a network cop procedural. I guarantee it. Yes.
All right. Eric Aho, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
You can find me. I don't know. I don't do this very often as far as TV criticism, but if you want to hear my music, you can go to my website, which is www.ericaho.com and listen.
Are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter. My Twitter account is Eric Aho Music.
Excellent. Actually, I'm not sure if I'm following you on Twitter. I probably should.
Not sure if I'm following you either.
Oh, no. A scandal.
It's a scandal.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. And please remember to check out my comics, books, and music. Go to anthonyjohnston.com for information and links to all of my work. You can support the show by rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes. And if you really like it, please leave a review. It's the best way to spread the word to new listeners. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find more information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Just quickly, the end of season one, what really disappointed me was the very end, like that final showdown, because the actual twist, I thought, you know, like the revelation of the murderer, I thought was really well done. All of that was kind of really well handled. But then the actual final showdown was so anticlimactic, and partly because they didn't kill off at least one of the detectives. And that really struck me as just wimping out, because it's like, you know, they'd already by that point said that they weren't going to bring back the same characters for season two. So, you know, use that to your advantage. You know, you've given yourself a way to do the old nobody is safe thing. And yet they didn't actually use it. You know, again, they made it look like Ross Cole was going to die, but then no, he's fine in the hospital. It's like, it just sucked a lot of the impact out of the ending for me. So I'm actually glad to hear that some of the characters at the end of season two do die.
Well, I agree too. I totally, and I didn't hate the ending of season one, because I liked.
I didn't hate it. I was just very disappointed.
I was disappointed. I didn't like him waking up in a hospital. I felt insulted when they did that. I was just like,
right.
He should have gone down.
Yeah.
But I liked, and I don't know, maybe I might be the only one in the world who'd say this, but I liked the conversation between Ross Cole and Woody Harrelson's character at the very end, because it became, if you're going to redo a redemption thing, if you're going to do something like that, it's a Hollywood ending, but it also felt kind of like, you know, the line that got to me, the line that I liked was that I kept going into the blackness. I kept going down and down and down. And then I reached this place that was soft and warm and benevolent. And I'm paraphrasing, but that line, it was like, okay, because Russ Cole's been looking at the abyss the entire season, right? And he's been staring into the abyss, and the abyss has been staring into him. And he descends all the way into the abyss right at the end. There it is above the guy that's murdering Woody Harrelson. Or is he murdering? I forget who saves who.
I think Woody Harrelson saves. Yeah. I think, Woody Harrelson's character saves, Russ Cole.
Russ Cole. Okay. So Russ Cole, so he's basically dying, you know, he's dying and so there's this, and it's not a deus ex machina, because he's, you know, he's stabbed, he goes into the, he's thrown into the pit, but it's there's something, he realizes there is a little bit of benevolence in the universe where he didn't see it before. So it's kind of his character does have this arc where he goes from complete nihilist to throwing himself or being thrown into the pit and then finding something to live for. You know what I mean? So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't awful, but it was, I felt there was something wrong about it.
It was. Yeah. Right. It's still, I mean, you're right. That scene was good, but I could have lived without it for the impact that killing off one of the characters would have had instead.
I agree with you. And that's why I thought season two's ending was more correct. To me, what happens at the end of season two is that, and we already talked a little bit about that, is Frank Semion dies, Velcoro dies, and Velcoro, I think a couple seasons before the finale, Velcoro and Bezzariti sleep together, and you realize and I'm not sure if, I can't remember if Velcoro knows it or not, or realizes it, but Bezzariti becomes pregnant. And so you end up, and Velcoro and it's more of a Chinatown ending where the house, again, it's more honest ending, to be honest, right?
The house always wins.
The house always wins. The people that write the history are the winners, right? So of course they're going to make themselves look good.
Right.
And so it's people like Velcoro and Semion who end up going down. Right. They're fatally flawed, or they just don't know, you know, they don't know the game they're playing. Even though, you know, they might have some good in them, or they might be struggling to be good in a corrupt world. They just don't have they're like the Ned Stark character, right?
Right. yeah. They're just naive. Yeah.
Right. Naive and kind of boyish in his duty to, God and country and yeah, politically naive. And so those people go, that's why I thought, well, it's the same reason why I thought killing Ned Stark off in that first season. And, you know, I have a lot of problems with Game of Thrones after that, but that to me, that first season and the way they ended that first season was just profound, because it says, you know, it says a lot about political naivete, and it says a lot about masculinity and what you have to do. And it says a lot about the world we all live in.
Yeah, well, and with Game of Thrones, I mean, that's the genius of the book, and George Martin, is that that's one of the reasons why the book had the impact that it did, because up until that point, you know, Ned Stark was the sort of character that up until that point in fantasy fiction would be the hero that would endure throughout the series. He was the guy who you would follow through an arc of books and sort of, you know, conquer evil, and no, that's not the kind of story that we're telling here. And that was why, I mean, I considered myself a latecomer, and I read Game of Thrones in like, something like 2002, 2003. And by then it was already not, you know, a new book. At the time it just blew me away. And that was what blew a lot of people away about, that book was that subversion of expectations.
It was unique, if nothing else. It was...
Right. At the time, now, of course, it's become de rigueur. Now it's actually, you know, it's more unusual if you don't have a fake out where you introduce a main character and kill him off, you know?
Right. And it becomes... And it's like that thing in Hollywood or that thing wherever you're like, oh, this is why it's good. Or it's, you know, and so we just need to repeat that and that'll make it good.
Right, right.
You know, I still think there's a lot of room for, you know, and if you were a student of history, you never, you know, myths, I think, served a different function when they were written, right? They're, mm-hmm. they're for people that are dealing with the everyday corrupt. That needs some sort of hope, where in our modern world, in our society, we're dealing with maybe a little too much comfort.
Right.
And we need more drama or something, yeah. Or we need more, you know, you're not going to find people getting a lot out of Game of Thrones or True Detectives in Syria. You know what I mean?
Right. Yes.
They don't need that because they're dealing with that kind of madness and the chaos of history.
Right. Those aren't the stories that they need. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Yeah. You need stories about, you know, good women and good men trying to act good and succeeding. So you have some sort of hope or else, you know, or else there's nothing, you know?
Right. Yeah. You got to have hope.